I wonder if you feel any sympathy for Nehemiah, the main character in the story that we were reading earlier. You might remember he's set off on this incredible task. He's gone to King Artaxerxes many months before, and he's taken his life into his hands to share with him the concern that he's got for God's people. He might well have been executed on the spot, just even for bringing it to the king's attention, but he took his life into his hands, he's brought it to the attention, and the God has answered his prayers. And his prayer was that he would be able to do something, to bring about an upturn in fortunes for the people of God, to do something about the walls of Jerusalem which were flattened and burned. Well, that was the beginning of the difficulties. He had this enormous journey back to Jerusalem. He carried that through with letters from the king to protect him along the way. And as he was going there and began then to get the people together and look, we can rebuild this wall. Are you with me? And the people were with him, and it seemed as though everything was going well. This great difficult task, but it seemed that God indeed was on his side, and that everything seemed to be going well. Well, that didn't last all that long, did it? That feeling, because then the problems started. The problems with just the size of the task initially and all the things that needed to be done. And it became so difficult, so the people were on the verge of giving up. There's just so much rubbish in the way, they were saying. Our strength is failing. It's just so hard. Full of enthusiasm at the beginning, but then the going gets tough. And Nehemiah's got to deal with the weariness of the builders and the people who are working. Tiredness is something we all struggle with, isn't it? In ourselves and in others. That was one of the problems that Nehemiah had to face. And then the other problem that Nehemiah's already had to face is the problem of opposition. Do you remember last time around that there were so many people around, people like Sanballat, for example, who were the enemies of God, along with Tobiah and others, and they didn't want this wall built. And they were making fun of the people, but they were also thinking of trying to actually physically stop them by attacking the people in the midst of the wall building. And Nehemiah's solution, the only thing that he could do would be to arm the people, to protect themselves against the opposition. So he says that for days and weeks, none of us even undressed. We slept in our clothes because we had to be on call, as it were, 24 hours a day in order that we could be able to defend ourselves. Half of us building, half of us with short swords and shields ready to defend the wall against those who would attack. It's been really difficult for Nehemiah. It's been a real struggle building this wall. And maybe you can relate to that. And maybe you're sympathetic to Nehemiah. Maybe you've tried at times to do something really worthwhile. Something perhaps that nobody else was willing to do. Something perhaps where you felt, I can serve the Lord with His help. I can't do it on my own, but with His help I can do this. And I want to do this to serve Him and to honour Him. You've taken on this great task. Maybe a ministry within a church, maybe something at home. And it started well, but it's just been a real slog. And you're tired, you're worn out. Seems as though there's opposition. And there's no end in sight. The problems just keep on coming. And maybe you're beginning to wonder, should I really be building this wall at all? Is this really what the Lord wants to do? Is this the Lord's way, these difficulties and these troubles, is this the Lord's way of shutting the door to this opportunity and moving me on to do something else? Maybe that's what you're thinking. It's just another problem. And then when you're feeling like that, suddenly, yet another problem comes crashing in. Because that's what happened to Nehemiah in chapter 5. There he was, just about getting through the problem with defending the wall against others, just about getting through the problem of tiredness. And then we read in chapter 5 and verse 1, there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. And now unity is at stake. What's actually got them through up until this point is their togetherness. Yes, there's been an enemy, Sanballat, Tobiah and so on, but they're enemies from outside. And we can stand together, as it were, shoulder to shoulder. And we can support one another and help one another, and I'll build your bit of wall and you build my bit of wall, and we'll be together. And there's been a real togetherness. That's what's kept them going. But now in chapter 5 and verse 1, the togetherness is seriously under threat, because this great outcry arises against their Jewish brethren. This is an internal problem now. It's not a problem with people outside. It's a problem inside. It's a problem with one another. There's this great divide that's come into the people of God. As I was reading various books to help me with this chapter, I read a particular book by Jim Packer. Some of you will know Jim Packer. An Anglican preacher and author who's written very many helpful things. And his take on Nehemiah chapter 4, 5 and 6, of all of these problems that Nehemiah was facing, his take on it was this. He says, this was Satan's doing. This is what Satan is trying to do, to pull apart the people of God, to divide the people of God. This is Satan's work. We can think in the New Testament, can't we? When not a wall was trying to be built in the New Testament, but this time the very church of God was being built in the book of Acts. Do you remember that? As after Pentecost, and people were converted, and the church was growing, and the church was being built up, and what happened in the book of Acts? Well, if you read the book of Acts around about chapters 4, 5 and 6, we find a very similar pattern to what's happening here in Nehemiah. Because in the book of Acts, we find too that there was opposition from outside the church initially in chapter 4. Because what we find there is that the Pharisees and the scribes and the religious leaders outside of Christianity, they were opposed to the building and the growing of the church. But then what happened afterwards is that the problems started to become more inward. We had the problem, first of all, with those who were pretending to give money to the church, but actually keeping it to themselves. And then we get to Acts chapter 6, and we find that there's a real problem of unity now. And the problem of unity is because there's some people in the church who feel that they're not being looked after properly, that they're getting neglected. And race and division comes into the church in chapter 6 of the book of Acts. Very similar in some ways to what's going on here in the book of Nehemiah. And maybe Jim Packer's right by saying this is something of the work of Satan, trying to disrupt from the outside. And then when things get really serious, to try and disrupt from the inside. And tragically, over the years, we've seen many churches and ministries and denominations ripped apart by schism and disunity and falling out. And it does a great disservice, doesn't it, to the kingdom of God, being disunited. This great outcry arising against their brethren. But that's what happened in the book of Nehemiah. It's what happened in the book of Acts. It's what's happened many times since. And sometimes it happens on a great big scale. That's what's going on with Nehemiah, isn't it? It's a whole city and the surrounding areas in uproar. Now, I don't suppose you and I will ever have responsibility as Nehemiah did, will we? I don't suppose any of us will ever be a governor of a nation or a land. We have relatively small responsibility, don't we? Maybe a little bit of responsibility in our homes. maybe a little bit of responsibility in a place of work, maybe a little bit of responsibility in the church, either in charge of a ministry or as part of a ministry. But within those areas, within the things that we're responsible for, exactly the same things can happen. There can be a group of three friends getting together to serve the Lord. And within those three friends, there can be three strong, different opinions that could pull people apart. You see, you don't need a great number of people to have problems with unity and division. It can happen in very small ways too. And really what I want us to think about this evening, particularly those of us who have responsibility for leadership, either in small areas or in larger areas, I want to think about the want us to think about the problems that can come and how we can handle that. How should we deal with difficulty when it comes in? It's one thing to deal with difficulty from outside, but how do we deal with difficulty from the inside? And Nehemiah chapter 5, actually along with Acts chapter 6 in many ways, gives us really helpful insight into that question. Now if you're not a leader, that doesn't mean that you can switch off and this is not for you. Because if you're not a leader, it presumably means that you're working with people who are leaders. Presumably means you're following folk. And we all have a responsibility, don't we? To be able to support one another, to help one another, to solve problems when they arise. If all we ever do is to sit back and say to our leaders, look, you sort it out, then probably nothing will be sorted. So for those of you who are not in positions of leadership at any level, this is deeply relevant to you too. It's relevant to all of us. Because the whole point, if we're going to solve a problem of disunity, as Nehemiah's got to do, then we've all got to be in it together. And therefore this is something that we all need to hear. So there's three things I think that Nehemiah does when this problem surfaces, and three things, therefore, that I believe that we can follow. Here's the first thing that Nehemiah does, and I'm looking now particularly at verses 1 through to 5. The first thing that Nehemiah does is he gets to the heart of the problem. He gets to the heart of the problem. And you see, this great outcry arises, and as this great outcry arises, it expresses itself in three or four different ways, as you can see in verses 2 through to 5. The first outcry is that we've got lots of sons and daughters, some people are saying, and therefore we need to get grain so that we may eat and live. Here's what's going on. Nehemiah has got the people together to build the wall. In order to get the people together to build a wall, particularly because they're having to stay day and night to protect it, they can't go home at night, nobody then is sowing the crops, or nobody is reaping the crops, whatever needs to be done. Their livelihoods have been put on hold in order to build this wall. And the longer the wall building goes on, the more difficult it's getting at home. Because people are doing this work. And as far as we know, they're not getting paid for it. And now, as a consequence, they're going hungry. It's been a major sacrifice to serve the Lord in this way. And people are now saying, we're going hungry. And the implication seems very strongly, we need to put this wall on hold so that we can go back and care for our family. That's our first responsibility. Our families must come first, mustn't they? That's what the first group is saying in verse 2. But the second group is saying in verse 3, actually for us it's perhaps a little bit worse, because what we've done is we've mortgaged our lands and our vineyards and our houses so that we might buy grain, because there's a famine going on. It's not just that we need to go back and till the fields, as it were. We've had to mortgage our fields and vineyards. We don't have that anymore. We've had to kind of sell things off because of this famine. So it's even worse for us. And then there are other people in verse 4 who says, well, look, we can't even pay our taxes. We're in danger now of getting thrown into prison by the king, because we can't even pay our taxes on the lands. We've had to borrow money to do that. We're in desperate straits. So the situation for these people now, verse 5, is that we're having to sell our children into slavery just to eat. That's how serious this is. And once we've sold them into slavery, we can't get them back. Because we've got nothing left to buy them back with. We're destitute. We're desperate. We've got this great problem. So Nehemiah listens to all of these complaints. He listens so that he'll understand what the situation is, because we get to the next section in verse 6 and following. He's gonna act there. But before he acts, he listens carefully to the whole range of complaints. And he realizes that this is an outcry against their Jewish brethren. Now here's the important thing. If you look at the complaints in verses 2, 3, 4 and 5, nothing is mentioned there about Jewish brethren. That's all in the introduction in verse 1. If you look at the complaints, the people are saying, my complaint is, I don't have enough food to eat. My complaint is, I don't have enough food to provide for my family. My complaint is, I don't have enough money to care for my children. That's the complaint. But that is the complaint. But why is that? As far as the people are concerned, it's because of the famine, verse 3. Can you see? It's the famine that's the problem. It's the king's tax, verse 4, that's the problem. That's the issue. That's what the people think. But actually, that isn't the issue. The issue is not the famine in verse 3. The issue is not the taxes in verse 4. That's not actually the problem. And Nehemiah realizes this, because he's thinking carefully about what the people are saying, and he's getting to the heart of the problem. You see, Nehemiah can't fix a famine, can he? Nobody can fix a famine. Nehemiah can't, even with the authority that he's got, he can't fix the problem of the king's taxes. He doesn't have the authority for that, and besides which, the king is hundreds or thousands of miles away. He can't fix that. He can't fix those problems, but thankfully those things are not actually the real problem. And here's the thing. Very often when people complain and they'll tell you about the things that are closest to them, the most immediate problem that they can see. It's the famine. It's the taxes. But actually Nehemiah saw through that. He realized that behind that problem was a deeper problem, was another problem. A problem maybe that the people themselves couldn't see. But a problem that if he stood back and was careful, he could see. In his description of it, the problem is the Jewish brethren. It's not the famine. It's not the taxes. The problem is us. We're the problem. And very often, that's what a leader will have to do. That's what a leader we'll have to see. The problem will be presented. We've got this difficulty. We've got this issue. And maybe people are offering suggestions as to what's causing the problem. And very often what people think causes the problem are things that are outside our control. It's always easier to blame things outside our control, isn't it? And that's what was happening here. It's the taxes. It's the famine. It's the things we can't control. It's everyone else's fault that's causing us problems. And in that situation, people just get depressed and down because there's nothing that can be done to fix it. But Nehemiah looks at the issue and he says, do you know what? The problem's not the famine. The problem's not the taxes. We're the problem. It's the Jewish brethren. It's the brothers. We're the problem. We're at fault. It's not the external things that need to change. It's we that needs to change. I said that the first thing that Nehemiah did and the first point of the sermon was get to the heart of the problem. Do you know what I mean by that? I'm not saying simply find out what the problem really is. I'm saying get to the heart of the problem. The problem of the human heart. Because very often it's not other things we need to fix. It's us we need to fix. It's a difficult thing for leaders to do. It's a difficult thing for those who are following to hear. But very often, when complaints are raised, we're the problem. We're the problem. So that's the first thing that Nehemiah does. He gets to the heart of the problem. But here's the second thing that he does, this time from verses 6 through to 13. Having got to the heart of the problem, now he deals with the problem decisively. He deals with the problem decisively. So you can see in verse 6, he becomes very angry when he hears their outcry and their words, and after serious thought, I rebuke the nobles and the rulers. He gets straight into it, doesn't he? There's no messing about. Once he's listened and he's heard the problem and he's thought it through, he's a man of action and he deals with it decisively. There's no pandering to the wealthy or the famous, as it were. He just deals with it. He grasps the bull by the horns and he gets on with it. It doesn't matter that it's difficult. It doesn't matter that it might upset people. It's the right thing to do, and therefore he does it. He deals with a problem decisively. There's a great lesson just there, isn't there, for those of us in leadership. It's absolutely vital that we don't let problems malinger on. And we deal with them decisively. That's so hard to do. That's so hard to do. I guess many of you will perhaps be like me, and sometimes you sort of think, well, I hope it sorts itself out. Let's give it time. And there can be wisdom in that sometimes. But if we do that through cowardice, then really that's demonstrating a problem with our own hearts, isn't it? We need to be brave. We need to be bold. We need to trust God, and we need to act decisively when problems arise. But notice how Nehemiah acted. Verse 6 spells out, and verse 7 spell out something very important. Because as Nehemiah heard the problems, the first thing that he did was he became angry. We often associate anger with sin, don't we? And of course, sometimes in our anger we do sin. But anger isn't necessarily sinful. You'll know that there are many times in the Bible where God is described as angry, and of course God doesn't sin. So being angry isn't of itself sinful. Uncontrolled anger is definitely sinful, leads to sin. But here Nehemiah is not about uncontrolled anger. Because what Nehemiah does, he becomes very angry in verse 6, and then after serious thought, he rebukes the noble and elders. Can you see the combination? There's real passion and there's life in Nehemiah. He gets really angry at the injustice of this. People are starving at the hands of their Jewish brothers. He rightly gets angry with this. But it doesn't stop him from thinking seriously and carefully about the problem and about the solution. So often when we get angry, we go off the deep end, don't we? And we just act without thinking, and we get into all kinds of mess, and very often we make the problem worse instead of better. But Nehemiah here, he gets angry, but he gives it serious thought. And if you're a leader, I suggest you, what a great model that is to follow. Yes, be passionate about your area of ministry. Be passionate about the things that you're responsible for. Be passionate about those things. And if they're being damaged by the behavior of other people, rightly be angry about that. But never go off on the deep end. Never lose your cool. Never lose your temper. No, couple your anger with serious thought. And only then speak, as Nehemiah does. There's something very powerful, isn't there? Maybe you've experienced this. I can think of teachers, for example, who got angry with disruptive pupils, but who never lost their cool. The teachers who lost their cool, you could handle that. You could live with that. It would blow up and it would be over. But those teachers who had this kind of settled anger against those who were disruptive, and you could see it in their eyes. Do you remember? Do you have teachers like that? Well, you didn't mess with teachers like that. And actually, that's much more in the way in which God deals with people, isn't it? God gets angry. But he has a settled opposition to wickedness and sin. He never flies off the handle. He never loses his temper. And therefore, men and women of God do the same. Just as Nehemiah did here. And he acts decisively, as he said, and he realizes the problem here is that actually the wealthy people are exploiting the poor. That's the problem. It's not the taxes. It's not the famine. The problem is that we, the nobles, he'll say that very clearly afterwards, we, the nobles, we're the problem. And he gathers the people together, the nobles together, and the rulers together. Remember, he's the ruler over this province. He's the governor. So he's one of them, as it were. He says very clearly in verse 10, I also, with my brethren and servants, am lending them money or grain. I'm part of this. But, he says, we're taking too much from our people. We're exacting usury, an exorbitant rate of interest. Isn't it fascinating how this story from 2,500 years ago has so much contemporary relevance? You remember the banking crisis and all the outcry about the 1% and so on? It's the same thing happening here 2,500 years ago. So how does he deal with it? When there's a problem in your area of ministry, where there's a problem in your home or your place of work, and it needs to be dealt with decisively, how do you deal with it? You gather together the people. We're part of the problem. And therefore we need to be part of the solution. But how do you convince other people of that? Nehemiah does three things to convince the other people of that. He appeals in verse 8 to their hearts. He says, remember what's happened. Our people, after Nebuchadnezzar came and attacked Jerusalem, our people were taken into slavery, into Gentile places. And do you remember what we did as Jews? We gathered together to buy our brothers and sisters back from Gentile slavery. Do you remember that? We were sold to the nations. And now look at what you're doing. You're behaving like the Gentiles. We've already brought these people back and now they're being sold all over again. He's appealing to the heart in verse 8. And then in verse 9 he appeals to the conscience. What you're doing is not good. You can feel they're going to start to feel guilty now, aren't they? Should you not walk in the fear of the Lord because of the approach of our nations, our enemies? He's reminding them of what God requires. He's demanding them the standards that we need to uphold, he's saying. Look at what God requires of us. What we're doing is wrong. And sometimes we need to say that. And that can be hard to say for a leader. Sometimes we need to say it. We appeal to the conscience. And then in verse 10, he also appeals to his own example. I also, with my brethren and servants, am lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. Now, as we read verse 10, people are divided a little bit as to how this should be read. Does it mean that Nehemiah is fully part of the problem and he's charging these exorbitant rates of interest just as everybody else is? I don't think that's actually what the verse means. I don't think that's what Nehemiah saying. He doesn't say, I'm exacting usury or I'm charging interest. He doesn't say that. He says simply, I am lending the money. And I think what Nehemiah is saying here is, look, I understand where you're coming from. I'm in this with you. I'm one of the nobles. Relatively speaking, I'm one of the rich people. I've got food on my table. I'm one of the 1%, as it were. So I'm having to lend money just as you are. I understand what it's like. But let's stop this usury. Let's stop this profiteering. Let's stop taking advantage of the poor. Let's stop doing that. And in Nehemiah saying, let us stop doing that, I don't think that's necessarily admission that he was doing that earlier. I think that's more identifying with his fellow lords and nobles and rulers. And he said, let's fix this together. You see, we can often be in a situation where there is a problem. And the problem is with us. And that doesn't mean to say that the leader is specifically at fault. The problem might be with other people within the group. But if we're the leader, then ultimately, and before God, we are responsible. We're responsible for the group. And therefore, it's no good for a leader to say, look, you're the one who's messed up, you sort it out. If you ever say that, that, I'm afraid, makes you a very bad leader. No, a good leader will say, let us sort this out. We're in this mess. Let's together sort out the problem. It's what Nehemiah does. So that's the second step. The first step was he got to the heart of the problem. The second step was he dealt with the problem decisively. The third step then, verses 14 to 19, is also vital. A good leader gives more than he demands from others. A good leader gives more than he demands from others. Because what happens now in verses 14 through to 19 is that Nehemiah tells a part of the story which basically says that he didn't take the privileges that he could have done as a governor of Judah. He didn't take a tax from the people to provide all the food for him and for the people that he had to entertain. He paid that out of his own salary. You can see that at the end of verse 14 and the beginning of verse 15. He says in verse 16, I continue to work building the wall. I didn't get land for myself. I spent my time trying to fix the problem for the people and trying to serve them and help them rather than just enriching my own bank account and my own land holdings. And it cost me a lot of money, verse 17 and 18, because I had to feed 150 people every day. But I paid it out of my own salary because I didn't want to be a burden on the people. You see, he'd asked other people, stop taking advantage. That's what he'd ask from others. Don't take advantage of the poor. And what does Nehemiah do himself? Well, of course, he doesn't take advantage of the poor, but he does more than that. He ends up not even taking what is rightfully his, what he's allowed to take under the law of the land. He doesn't even take the taxes that as a governor he could have done. You see, Nehemiah gives more than he demands from others. That's the sign of a godly leader. He gives more than he demands from others. And if you're a leader in ministry, whether it's in here in the church or a leader at home or a leader in your place of work, if you start demanding things from others that you're not prepared to give yourself, and you're not prepared to do even more than the things that you're asking of others, then very soon the people that you're trying to lead will rise up against you. They'll think of you as a hypocrite. And frankly, they'll be right to do so. No, a leader gives more than he demands from others. So as we looked at Nehemiah chapter 5 then, we found, I think, some helpful things that can help particularly those who are in leadership. But surely there's more than that. Surely there's more than that. And yes, absolutely there's more than that. Because what we find as we look at Nehemiah chapter 5 is that the way that Nehemiah chapter 5 reflects exactly, we've touched on this already, the way that God himself deals with his people. Because if you're looking for an example of leadership, yes, we can look to Nehemiah here as a great example of leadership. We could look to people like David or the Apostle Paul or the elders of the church in Jerusalem and find these great examples of leadership. But of course, the greatest example of leadership is God himself. And what we find as we look at Nehemiah chapter 5 is it's almost as if Nehemiah himself is using God as his example. So let's look again quickly at what Nehemiah has done. First thing that Nehemiah has done is he's got to the heart of the problem. The people think the problem is one thing. The people are pointing out that the problem is all the external things. But Nehemiah realized actually the problem is not what's external. It's not the famine. And it's not the taxes, the problem is with us. The problem is with our hearts. And you think of how the Lord deals with the biggest problem of all. That great crisis, as it were, the problem of human sin. How does the Lord deal with that? Well, the Lord, again, gets to the absolute heart of the problem, doesn't he? God doesn't blame the external, as it were. That's what Adam and Eve try and do. It was the woman that you put here on the earth. It was the snake that you put here. Adam and Eve both blame the external. What does God say? No, the problem is not the external. The problem, Adam and Eve, is the human heart. That's the problem. And the Lord gets to the heart of the problem. And he deals with it decisively then, doesn't he? Just as Nehemiah dealt with this issue decisively, as God is solving, as it were, this problem of sin, as God is leading us through this great difficulty, he deals with it decisively. Yes, he gets angry at sin, absolutely he does, but he never flies off the handle. If God had flown off the handle, then humanity would have come to an end right back in Genesis chapter 3, wouldn't it? But God is patient. And despite the continued sin and the continued opposition that men and women place before God, you think of the Tower of Babel, you think of the violence before the flood, that's just the first few chapters of Genesis, and it goes on and on and on and on. But God is patient, and God takes his time, as it were. And God gives the matter serious thought. I'm not suggesting there that God somehow is perplexed and he doesn't know what to do and he takes a long time to work it out. I don't mean that, because that's, of course, that God doesn't operate in that way. But what I mean is that God settles in his heart, in himself, in his mind, as it were, the answer to this problem. And the answer to the problem, well, we need to be rebuked, don't we? We need to be rebuked for our sin. And God appeals to our hearts, and he appeals to our consciences, and he sets this great example himself of how we should live, and he reminds us in some of the stories of the Bible, we can see that the way that he works in history, and it makes us ashamed when we see the great example that God has set, and the poor example of ourselves in comparison. He appeals to our consciences as he tells us very plainly, the way that we're living is wrong. You're sinning against me and against one another. This is not good. This is not right. It's what God says to us through his word. And then he sets the example himself through his patience and his grace and his mercy and his care and his love for the people. And he shows us what it all should look like and how we should be living. And yet wonderfully and gloriously, even more than Nehemiah, God himself says, let us stop this. You see, Nehemiah is counting himself, as it were, amongst those who are sinning, amongst those who are exacting usury from his brother. And I don't think Nehemiah was doing that, but he's got the grace to say, as it were, let us stop doing this. And in an even greater way, it's what God does. Because he doesn't stop up there in heaven, as it were, and say, look, you're in a mess, you need to sort it out. He steps down from heaven, and he becomes one of us. Isn't that the glory of the gospel? God in human form? And as it were, as one of us, God fixes this problem, just as one of the nobles, Nehemiah, fixed the problem. And then, of course, as God fixes this great problem of human sin, he gives more than he ever demands from others. Oh, the glory of it. Of Jesus Christ giving himself. And he demands wholehearted obedience, yes. But he gave that. He gave that. He demands sacrifice. We've got to leave everything and follow him, as we've seen from Sunday mornings. Oh, yes. But he did that. He left the glories of heaven. We don't have to leave the glories of heaven. But that's what he did. That's what he did. And he demands sacrifice and a willingness to give up our very lives. Yes, he does. But what did he do? Our God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. Hands that flung stars into space to cruel nails surrendered. As he sacrificed and gave himself in a greater way than he ever demands from us. Jesus Christ, you see, God himself is this great example of leadership. An example that you and I will never ever match. And we'll never get there. We probably won't ever be as good a leader as Nehemiah, and we'll certainly never be as good a leader as Jesus. But through his grace and mercy, Jesus does what we cannot do. And Jesus has done, therefore, what we will never need to do. He has taken the weight of sin and shame. He has taken our guilt. He's taken our punishment. He has taken our hell. He's given more than he ever demands from us. And because he has loved us and given himself for us, then we're free. Free to follow. Free to do likewise. Free to honor him in the way that we lead, in the way that we treat one another, in the way that we love one another because of Jesus.